This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will hear from Mashir Robinson of the Louisiana NAACP. He was the chair of the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington in 1983. It was 50 years ago tomorrow, August 28, 1963, that Dr. Martin Luther King delivered the I Have a Dream speech, 14 minutes that captivated America and a generation or two to follow. Delivered to more than a quarter million civil rights supporters from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, it stands as perhaps the greatest speech of the 20th century. We'll talk with Mashir Robinson about the legacy of Dr. King, about race in Louisiana, about why he moved from Baton Rouge and now lives in New Orleans. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We'd love to hear from you today. 297-5633 is the Baton Rouge number, and outside the local calling area, 877-217-5757. As always, you may reach us online, Inkstershow at WRKF.org. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and we're one day away from the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, 14 minutes that changed the world from Dr. Martin Luther King. And we will talk with Mashir Robinson, an activist who lives in Louisiana, who was involved as the chair of the 20th anniversary event in Washington of the speech that electrified our country. Here's how it sounded 50 years ago in Washington.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Martin Luther King, August 28th, 1963. He was 34 years old. Perhaps the most stirring address since Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address a century earlier. Martin Luther King died less than 5 years later, and of course President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was dead within 5 months of the I Have a Dream speech. Mashir Robinson, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning, my dear Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. You're old enough to remember that speech, when it happened. What was the response at the time?
Well, I was sitting in the living room with my father and mother, and I wept, and because I'm biracial by heritage. My native language is German. I was born on a military base in Germany. My dad was doing service, and my family is from Virginia and North Carolina, and in the summers, I would travel down to the south from Jersey City where I was living. And my mother couldn't travel with me, and I had to go by myself on the Greyhound bus and sit in the back. And I didn't have this orientation towards that kind of stark segregation our brothers and sisters faced in the South. And so I invariably would just wander into a bathroom and get pitched out or get threatened or whatever would happen. And my grandmother would try to explain to me what I could and could not do. At the same time, in the North, integrating the Catholic school system in Jersey City, I used to have gang fights by myself against little Irish and Italian kids. So when I was watching that speech about this dream of a convivial world, I just wept the whole time. And with my mother and father and little brother at the time kind of holding hands watching it. So for us, it had an enormous ramifications in terms of a hope for our humanity.
That speech was a masterful address by Dr. Martin Luther King, prepared at the famous Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. I'm sure he had no idea it was going to be as pertinent as it has been for half a century, and there have been great speeches since then by various people. Why has that one stood the test of time and gained a following for people who were not born in 1963?
Well, as you know, it's really odd, because in 63, Martin spoke last. In fact, in the Washington Post, they did not even mention Dr. King's speech. It was in the New York Times, where there was at the time. And so nobody really had this anticipation of what it meant. In fact, some of Dr. King's closest advisors had counseled him not to use this reflection of having a dream that he had in previous speeches. But he went off script with Mahalia Jackson sort of urging him from behind to tell your dream, Martin. And what seemed to have happened is sort of like, for Christian of you, the Holy Spirit took control of him, and he laid out a call to America to reconnect with its hope and its founding. Not a perfect union, but something that could be made more perfect, and he called for that to happen immediately, which it needed to. And I think that spiritual power has resonated and continues to resonate, because that particular march and his address was not just about racial conviviality, but it was also in a march for jobs and justice, so that it had also this thing that obviously hits us today, where we have about an 18% black unemployment rate in Louisiana of adults, and God knows what it is for young people. So that speech carries to us in Louisiana today and throughout the country, where we still have this very, very sharp economic dichotomy, and continue to even have, across all strata, quite a bit of racial, what one would call animus, too much.
Well, this speech at the time, in August of 1963, was just over 2 months after the murder of Medgar Evans in Mississippi.
Yes.
It was less than 5 months away from the murder of John Kennedy in
Yes.
Dallas, and less than 5 years away from the murder of Martin Luther King in Memphis.
Yes.
Those were tough times, and the times often generate attention that otherwise they would not. But I think this speech was strong enough that it would have been pertinent at any time.
Yes, and that's why I think it continues to resonate today. I mean, there's such a, what you can call it, a dual consciousness, a reality in America, where Anglos believe, 70% believe that there's been, basically, that we have equality today, whereas under President Obama, only 26% of African Americans believe we have equality, and only 25% believe we've made improvements under Obama, which is very strange. If you think about this kind of panacea of hope that many black folks had in the election of Obama. So his speech would be part of a speech he would have delivered at this 50th anniversary march. I don't think he would have focused purely on the progress we've made, but would rather continue to focus on the need to agitate for America to become more inclusive, as opposed to balkanized sort of the way we still are.
Governor Jindal wrote a piece to Politico a few days ago, this one much better received than his last one. He writes, "Racism is one of the more tragic features of the human condition. Like greed, envy, and other sins, it has been around for thousands of years on every continent. So here we are in the most advanced, successful, and powerful nation in the history of the world, and yet we continue to struggle to get past the color of each other's skin." That from Bobby Jindal. Now, you have commented on this show, Mashir, that you moved from Baton Rouge, the birthplace, hometown of Governor Jindal, because mm-hmm. you experienced, and your family experienced, prejudice in this community. What happened here to you?
Well, I'll tell you a story. My son, who's at Columbia, going to medical school, he was home a few summers back, and we lived on Woodstone, which is near off Highland Road near LSU. And he was bouncing a basketball on his way to the basketball court. That's because of a private neighborhood. We got a private thing in the back. And about six cops came, pick him up, threw him in the back of the car. And if my wife hadn't been home, they would have taken him to jail for report of breaking and entering. When I first started driving up my block, I got stopped numerous times by the police who wanted to know where I was going or what I was doing. I mean, it's sort of kind of my son, my other son, who was at the lab school, wrote a paper on why Western science is not the highest form of civilization and noted some contributions of the African griots and the New Zealand Maori and the way in which they made baskets, etc. And he was failed, even though he had a Harvard professor as his mentor for the project, because he challenged that. So it's difficult. As having been, you know, the chairman of economic development for the NAACP, and trying to get people on boards and involved in leadership to create transformational kinds of opportunities, even trying to get the newspaper, The Advocate, to host conversations around it, work with the Chamber of Commerce, anybody. It just seemed like there was just such a stone wall and a hard heart to engage in the reality we have of underdevelopment in the black community, both in education, socially, and economically. And so I just finally, given the things that were going on in New Orleans and the fact that I moved here to help with Katrina, we decided to move to New Orleans, which has much more of a, let's call it, convivial, not a perfect environment, but at least an environment where there's some diversity happening.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk with Mashir Robinson, who is affiliated with the Louisiana NAACP at high levels and also was the chair of the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington in 1983. Now, you were living in this neighborhood where your son had his problems, correct?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I lived on the street where he got picked up by the police.
All right, well,
but I guess I wasn't supposed to own this sort of house. It just, you know, the same thing. I mean, my youngest daughter going to St. Aloysius, because we're Catholic, and so we're basically one of the few African-American families there. And just the treatment my wife got from the people who were not, you know, they just weren't open in any kind of way, despite having a fabulous principal who tried very, very hard to create dialogue and openness. It just, you know, we got such a long way to go when it comes to black and white folks having, in Baton Rouge in particular, having even social relationships, forget economic relationships, where they go to each other's houses, where they share things, where they pray together, where they do the things that make for civilization and community a better place. So we have a long, long way to go in Baton Rouge. And since I'm an outsider to the community, having moved to Louisiana, it seems that I'm better off in a more open space, which we have in Louisiana. Now we know we spend a lot of time in D.C.
Well, the reality is that on most streets in Baton Rouge, you wouldn't even be living on those streets. The neighborhoods remain largely segregated in this community. They're either all black or all white, and most streets are all black or all white.
That's correct. And I just find that to be so sterile. You know, it's to the detriment of everybody. Everybody's assumptions, it's sort of, and this is what's odd. I mean, Kip Holden has tried, you know, to deal with opening up China. And it's so odd that, you know, we have this great renaissance going on.
Hold that thought. We'll talk with Mashir Robinson when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Mashir Robinson, who is with the Louisiana NAACP and was the chair of the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington. Tomorrow marks 50 years since August 28, 1963, when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. closed with a flourish with his stirring address that captivated more than a quarter million people who were at the mall in Washington, and also captivated millions of Americans and others years after. 877-217-5757, wherever you may be, to join the conversation with Mashir Robinson. Now, you were talking about Kip Holden, the mayor of Baton Rouge.
Yeah. So I was saying that Kip had, you know, has invested in trying to create and bring Chinese business, universities, other people to be involved in our community, try to open it up a bit and create more competitive spirit. But within our community, we're still fighting a black and white battle as opposed to understanding what global best practices are, that we're not competing narrowly for a few resources between us, blacks and whites, but rather we're competing to make sure that our children and our businesses can compete globally so we can all win together. That notion, it's just unfortunately not there.
Well, in Louisiana, we did elect a dark-skinned man as governor of our state, in Bobby Jindal. We have been ahead of the curve as far as electing women to high positions in government. Are there some glimmers of hope amid the problems that you obviously have faced personally?
Well, personally, I'm sort of in a very transcendent position. I've had every kind of opportunity in the world one could imagine beyond my my own capabilities, I would even say, the way the Lord's blessed me. But looking at this situation with Governor Jindal as an example, Governor Jindal has had to liquidate a lot of himself, I think, in trying to be Bobby, in other words, to be this person who speaks more Southern and comes more conservative and separates himself from his own realities. I mean, we should have fabulous relationships with India. We should be trying to promote Indian business and doing this, that, and the other. I'm sure there are things that have tugged on him that hold him even back from being totally fulfilled. And the fact that we elect Anglo women to leadership positions on a statewide basis, a few from time to time, including our senator, I mean, that doesn't in itself tell any story. And when Mary tries to stand up and to lean, let's call it lean forward in a certain kind of way, she gets huge backlash, and she's threatened with reelection this time in a very, very serious way. So I'm not clear that simply being a woman is a benchmark of progress, or being a person of color, like our governor, who is ultra-conservative and whose policies do not promulgate the kind of conviviality we're discussing, is a sign that we've evolved a lot in Louisiana in terms of our racial kind of progressiveness.
We have distinct issues in our state, among the worst in America when it comes to crime and poverty, and race is often a factor in those issues, and yet those issues are not talked about in the essay in Politico from Bobby Jindal. No mention of the poverty level or the murder rate, which is the worst in the United States, in New Orleans and Baton Rouge not far behind. Why do we not address the elephant in the room?
Because I think the we in this context is, let's call it, the greater body politic majority population would rather kind of lives in its own separate reality that doesn't address the real world. We have today 50% of African-American males under 25 have some form of arrest record. Half. Now, that means that half of the black population, in some way or other, going forward, is inhibited in terms of their potential in employment and economics. And that is a cauldron for disaster. In fact, I hate to mention this guy's name, but Lenin, back in 1918, wrote about the grave diggers of capitalism being the lumpenized, meaning those people who would become declassed one way or another. And we have too many declassed African-Americans who don't feel they have any stakeholding in the future. And we have a lot of people, because of that, that do horrible things like these murders. And on the other hand, a lot of people are just fundamentally broken and discouraged because they got picked up for some traffic violation or a joint or something that if they had been Anglo or more affluent, they could have overcome that problem. So this is deep, deep, deep problem.
297-5633 for Mashir Robinson, joining us from New Orleans. How long did you live in Baton Rouge, Mashir?
For 6 years.
Okay. Faye on Segan Lane. Faye, good morning. You're on the air with Mr. Robinson.
Good morning. I was just listening, and it just brought really sadness to my heart to hear what Mr. Robinson said about his kids going to Catholic school. He's Catholic. Obviously, the kids that were going there were Catholic as well, and how they were treated. And then when he said about people of different races should, you know, they should be able to pray together, that is the one thing I think that really is so disheartening to me, that many people who claim to be Christian really don't truly feel that way about people who look differently from them. And really and truly, if we're Christian, we should be following what the Bible says. And the Bible clearly says that God is not partial. So I think people who look at folks that are different from them in color or what have you really should maybe assess their values, what they deem to be Christian, because certainly they cannot be. If you look at someone at a different race, you know, because they're a different race, as being less than you or to be treated in a condescending manner, that really hurts my feelings for many people. Thankfully, I don't have that problem where I worship, because I have a worldwide brotherhood, people of many different nationalities and races. I just went to a convention in Lake Charles where there were like over 4,000 people, and I saw people of so many different races, and all I saw was love among people who had never even met each other. So it really hurts my feelings for people who have to be in that kind of environment, especially if you're going to worship and people can't even sit next to you or touch you because you're of a different race. So I just think people really need to reassess their Christian values and look at what the Bible truly does say at Acts 10:34, because if we're Christian, we should be trying to imitate God, and he is not partial.
All right,
that's
Faye.
That's all I wanted to say about it.
Faye, if you're still with us, may I ask what part of the city do you live in?
Oh, I actually live in Prairieville, but I work off Segan Lane.
Okay, so do you live in a neighborhood that has blacks and whites?
Oh, yeah.
In Prairieville. And
many
African-Americans, believe it or not, have moved to Ascension Parish from Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
But in Baton Rouge, as I stated, you go down most streets in this city, and even though this city has now veered blue while the rest of the state has gone red politically, most of the streets are segregated.
Oh, I agree with that about the streets. I agree with that. What I was going from the standpoint of when Robinson, when he said about people being able to worship together, that in itself is something I don't have to deal with because of my faith. We truly are a worldwide brotherhood, and all people are created by God. Now, in my neighborhood, oh, I know what you're talking about. Even in my neighborhood, I see it. But at least when I go to worship, I know that these are my brothers and sisters. And, I mean, I could go to Russia, and I'm African-American. Quite naturally, the people that I would go and worship with would definitely be of a different race from me, but I would be accepted. I have been to different places where my husband and my son and I were probably the only African-Americans, but we walked into the building and people embraced us. Hi, how you doing? Where are you from? Invite us to dinner. just because they know this is my spiritual brother or sister.
All right, let's get Mushir to respond to Faye on Segan Lane. Mushir?
I think that she's made a I think she's part of a new Christian community, which is in its vibration creating a lot of interesting cultural and worship relationships, and I really celebrate that. For whatever reason, God ever never let me get out of the Catholic Church. And unfortunately, even though we pray every Sunday against racism, when it comes down to actually getting our bishops, like Munch and Baton Rouge, to get really down in the weeds on this issue, this is a real problem. We don't get in the weeds of this issue. We have tried to involve him at various conventions and conferences. There was a book on the history of the Catholic Church in the Diocese of Baton Rouge, and it never mentioned the role of the church in segregation. We played a big role in segregation in Louisiana and maintaining it.
Paul Anopoulosis, thank you, Faye. Paul, good morning. You're on the air with Mushir Robinson.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Robinson. Being Catholic myself, I'm not Catholic, just the priests. There's a rainbow coalition of priests in Catholic Church. Now, you know that from Africa, India, North America, South America. But my question was this, though. Do you, and that's to Jim, too, do you see politics, conservative, liberal, being some kind of new religion as to whether people grade people left, right? We know Barack did not win, say, Louisiana, but 90% of blacks in Louisiana voted for Barack. Do you see politics as a new religion, as how people grade each other morally, I should say?
All right.
I think he's raised a very, very good question. I think regardless of your in faith, in quote, your faith orientation or denomination, it sort of plays itself out as a kind of religion when we think about politics. We really, really manifest our politics as a faith. And how we can dialogue, whether it's dialoguing between denominations or dialoguing between parties, when people are so consolidated to one view of reality, from their soul to the way in which they live socially, as he points out, our politics essentially become a religion that we practice from birth to the grave.
Well, we have made some strides in Louisiana. Edwin Edwards was the first Roman Catholic to be elected governor, and now we've had a succession of Catholics, in particular Kathleen Blanco and Bobby Jindal, who have been elected. But I think what Paul was stating was that can you determine a person's positions on any number of other issues by how they stand on the President of the United States?
I think you can. I mean, unfortunately, it seems that you can. There's too much predictivity in that, and I wish that wasn't the case. And I think his point was even deeper than the one you just made about the fact that we've had several Catholics of different types of positions elected. There's huge pressure from our church to promulgate certain issues like abortion as the main topic, but the parallel topic, which is what do you do for those children once they're born, despite Catholic Charities and many other things, from an overall political context, we're not quite there.
Robert in Mid-City. Robert, good morning. You're on the air. Hi, Robert.
Hi, I was just wanting to comment about racism. I think racism is an evolutionary thing. I think we just tend to like people that look like us rather than people that don't look like us. And I think the closer you can get around people that look like you, the more comfortable you're going to be around them. And there's no amount of legislation that you're going to be able to do.
All right. What about Robert's statement that we just tend to hang out with our own kind?
Well, if we simply hung out with our own kind, then there would only be a few consolidated kinds in the world. And that isn't true. We are, in fact, a rainbow of different kinds of peoples. The fact is, it's not that we're completely flawed. We're just evolving, let's call it, to in national terms, to a more perfect union where we are more convivial and within each other in our connections. That's the way we are. So I think that it's more social than biological in terms of the humankind, in terms of the way in which we react. And there are these social constructs of language, religion, and other things that kind of keep us in certain boxes. But it isn't. But those are social constructs and not genetic.
Mike on I-10. Mike, good morning. You're on with Mashir. Please be brief, Mike.
Yes, I'm just interested in his feelings and thoughts on Pope Francis.
On Pope Francis, what do you think of the new Pope?
Well, I'm a lover of this guy. I mean, one of the things people don't know about Francis, who he's named after, is that St. Francis of Assisi was a very, very close friend of Saladin, who was the great Islamic leader who was fighting the Christians in the Crusades. And it was a result of that friendship that Saladin's son gave the Holy Land without a fight back to the Christians to manage, who then screwed it up again by pogroms against the Jews, the killing of the Orthodox, a lot of other things. So Francis, one of the first things he did was to visit with the Grand Mufti to make openings to the Islamic world. And I think in part the taking of his name is much more about the kind of things that Francis represented in global politics, in a certain sense, spiritually, in the call of Christianity, than taking care of animals, where people kind of thought about that more, about this gentle guy, than in fact the notion that Francis, St. Francis, his namesake, was this really giant of thought.
James on Monterey, please be brief. James, you're on with Mashir. Hi, James.
Hi. I worship at a church where there are almost never any blacks in attendance, and part of the excuse is that three or four blocks away there is another church in the same denomination where everybody is black. So my question is whether traditional black institutions like churches and the separate university system and Grambling, for example, are actually holding us back from getting together in the same institutions. Thank you.
I think this caller's question is very, very interesting. Two things I'll say quickly. One is I go to a church, it's called St. Jude's, in New Orleans. It's the most integrated church you could ever go to. We have an Italian priest and black deacons, and we worship in a style that's open and resonates Louisiana's broad culture, jazz, blues, all of that. So it draws everybody together. So I don't think we have to, if the issue is we have to liquidate institutions or close institutions, they have to be done in a way that upholds, in quote, the minorities.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Mashir Robinson of the Louisiana NAACP. He helped organize the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington. Tomorrow marks a half century since Martin Luther King delivered his address before more than a quarter million people. The speech was ranked as the top American speech of the 20th century in a 1999 poll of scholars of public address. Before we hit the break, you were in full bloom, Mashir. I wanted you to finish your thoughts before we go to the next
thing. I want to go to Grambling and Southern and these sort of schools, Dillard, Xavier. So many African-American kids have come through our public school system, which is still separate but equal, and they don't get an opportunity to get the intense remedial or focused, positive kind of spiritual uplift that they need, which they end up getting in these historically black colleges and universities, which then turn these candidates into competitive students for graduate degrees in all white schools. I shouldn't say white, but, you know, let's call it majority schools, because none of the schools anymore are all white or all black in that context, because there's so many Asian kids and stuff that are top performers in these universities. But these schools are just fundamental to consolidating and saving and lifting up youth, and without them, we just would not have the graduation rates. And when you look at the dropout rates of African Americans at majority universities, whether they're LSU or Michigan or Brown or Harvard, they're horrible. So these places are safe havens for young people who are still forming who they are as human beings.
Betty at City Park. Hi, Betty. You're on with Mashir.
Thank you for taking my call. I just like to say why I applaud anybody who takes up an issue or a cause. I just think that, you know, we are always trying to make blacks feel as if they are second-class citizens. I think there's just too much talk about that. I think, you know, the forefront of someone coming forward needs to come from within themselves and not so much as somebody taking up their calls all the time. There are just as many other the people that actually have the type of issues that black people are having, that, you know, the cross section of all races, but we just seem to always want to make seem like blacks are the second citizens, and I take offense to that.
Mashir?
Well, I think that there can be a victimhood kind of mentality where black folks can say, oh, woe is me, and not see beyond the boundaries. And that's why I've suggested that the real competition, the real problem, is in the context of American working class having the kind of reach and knowledge they need to compete globally. Even our business class doesn't necessarily understand that. And so we have an underdevelopment overall of how we're moving forward. However, we do have special problems as African Americans, and not to address those problems would be wrong.
297-5633. Thank you, Betty. David at LSU. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. Which program do you have in Louisiana where Caucasian people are moving into black neighborhoods to show us how to get along? And the second program would be early childhood development. Which black American group is pushing early childhood development and showing that it is working?
All right. What about whites moving into black neighborhoods? We don't see too much of that, but I would think it would be interesting if some of these...
Well, we see it in Harlem, Jim. Harlem has transferred itself from being sort of both a black mecca of certain amount of wealth, et cetera, as well as poor poverty. Today, Harlem, to get a brownstone, costs $800,000. That's a shell. So we have huge number of Anglos moving into that community, and that's true in other parts of the United States. It first began with, in quote, the gay community moving in and doing urban homesteading, but now it's across the board where people are moving in, and there's some very interesting things going on in Brooklyn and Harlem and a number of places on the East Coast where this phenomena is in full bloom of Anglos moving back into the city.
Well, it would be fascinating if something like that were to happen here in Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
Lily at LSU. Lily, good morning. You're on with Mashir Robinson.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. Hi, Jim. Hi, Mr. Hi. Robinson. I just
Hi.
Want to make a very quick comment to thank the speaker, who was more than articulate and eloquent with pointing out such a real issue of segregation and sorting, and we see it all the way up through graduate school with our students at LSU. We're working to try to point it out, and all I want to say is thank you for just bringing up this critical issue at a time after the, I feel, very disappointing outcome of the Trayvon Martin case, and I think racism is alive and well, not to victimize anyone, but just to also bring awareness and continue to try to counter a real issue of unfair treatment. Thank you. And I'm very sad what happened to your son, but it is all too alive in this city.
Thank you, Lily.
Mashir,
you played college football, correct?
I played college football, basketball, ran track, and rugby. I was a jock.
Were you in the minority on those teams?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I went to Brown in the late 60s, early 70s, there were just a handful of African-American students. And what was interesting was I decided to go to an Ivy League school and not Notre Dame. I was a first-team high school American because I wanted to be a doctor. And but despite my being recruited by everybody in the world, not one Southern team, I couldn't have gone to LSU. It would have been impossible. But at Brown, yeah, I was one of four people on our team. We could never on the basketball team have more than two African-Americans on the court. And this is in an Ivy League Northeast school. That was just the reality. And we've come a long way in sports since then, but not so much on the coaching field where we still have so few of our people coaching. And then the other thing, the real big tragedy that I must state, is that our kids are basically, whether they're white or black, playing college ball or slaves. I mean, your parents can't even go and visit you. You're a poor kid. You can't. Your parents can't be paid to fly to see their kid play ball. So this thing with Johnny Manziel, who happens to be an Anglo quarterback, the Heisman Trophy winner, I just think that, that's another whole front, going back to what the lady said before about where there are black folks and white folks who share in deprivation, and in athletics we share in a lot of deprivation.
Well, you can go see your kids play. You just have to pay to do it. Nobody's preventing.
Yeah, that's my point. They can't afford to do it. You look at the college rosters of these. I mean, if we did an economic map, the vast majority of these kids are poor.
Well, and, a few months ago, the Daily Reveille, the LSU student newspaper, had a survey of an analysis of the faculty at LSU, and there were 52 African-American professors on the whole campus.
That's right.
52, and there are more than 52 African-Americans on the football team, which is now over three-quarters African-American. Is there a disconnect there?
Huge disconnect. I'll give you a very specific example. My brother, who has two masters from MIT, a Cornell undergraduate, a University of California PhD, has moved here to Louisiana. And he's having a hard time getting a job, even though he's a leader in brain chemistry research. He's not been able to place. He just wants to be closer to me and can't get a faculty position. So it just gives you the kind of the way in which you, if you're an outsider to the culture, they're just in academia, it's pretty bad.
You were at Brown University in what years, Mashir?
In 69, 70, 71, 72, then I was a Rhodes Scholar, went to Oxford.
Okay, so your background is almost identical to that of Governor Jindal.
It is, except I'm much older.
Well, yeah, 20 years or so. But Brown University, and I've never been to Brown University, but I'm told it's quite a liberal bastion of thought. And how did the governor survive there?
Well, you know, this is total hearsay on my part. My understanding is from friends of mine that knew him in high school is that he was very, very, and wasn't, let's call it, as conservative as he is now. And so at Brown provides space for literally any kind of person. And when I was in school, that was not the case. It was a fraternity-dominated school, and we had literally building takeovers and strikes and every other kind of thing, which created the Brown of diversity today. So I think he probably is just a different person then, and he's evolved to where he is now.
You must have been, what, about 18 or so when Martin Luther King delivered? Well, I guess, no, you were about 13 when Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech, an impressionable age. If he had lived, what kind of impact would he have had?
I think if he had lived, for him to have lived and not to have been assassinated, remember one of the big things that he did, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, is he was in a conversation with Malcolm about taking the United States to the World Court and to the United Nations. I think there would have been a much deeper confrontation around the U.S. economic system, which was part of the Poor People's March and everything else. So I think America would be in a different place. And so that him being alive today would not just simply be him talking from a pulpit about the problems we see today and the way we see them. I think the country would have been in a different place. And that's at least my belief.
Well, he died on April 4th, 1968, only 39 years old, by the way.
Yes.
Many years to go, quite likely would be alive today if he had not been assassinated by James Earl Ray. At least we think it was James Earl Ray in Memphis, Tennessee. Do you recall when he was killed?
Yes, I do, because my family was in Newark, New Jersey, and the whole place erupted into, as you know, rebellions. We had massive rebellions in Newark, even before the death of King. But then after his death, I mean, the place just went up. And I remember the day he died and feeling like all hope was gone. That was the way I felt in my soul, seeing the absolute horror and frustration of people that could lead them to want to burn everything and destroy everything because they felt destroyed in his death.
You can understand the anger, though.
Oh, absolutely. But how people can ultimately be triggered, it's hard for me, despite frustration and anger, to be that despondent that I'd want to destroy. But clearly that's how deep the roots of this race thing have become, that it was possible for that to occur. And if you remember, at the March on Washington, even Kennedy, they were going to have martial law, and they set up for martial law because this big notion that all these folks are going to come and destroy. That's not the way our folks are, but there's an element that has been so degraded that they would allow that to happen and exercise that kind of frustration.
David in Alabama. David, good morning. You're on with Mashir. You're on
Hello.
The air. Yes, you don't have to tell me who you are. We know. What's your question?
Well, I didn't have a question. I just heard that I'm traveling right now, and I'd heard there were some comments about the biases of Baton Rouge's involvement or lack of involvement in racial issues in town. And, you know, as being the executive director of Catholic Charities, there have been a number of things in my tenure the past few years that we've been involved in that have taken significant strides to cross racial barriers and try to bring the community together. For example, one of the newest and most successful voices that gives real power and significance to minorities in Baton Rouge is the Together Baton Rouge organization, which has been funded by the U.S. Catholic Conference bishops for the past few years. That's how that organization got started.
So some good things going on with your organization, Catholic Charities, and Mashir has commented that as a Roman Catholic, he's faced discrimination at schools and churches. As long as we have people, we're going to have prejudice. But when do we have a case where it's an alarming situation? Are we there right now? Do you think we're still there, Mashir, right here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana?
I think we are, and I think that there are heroic people trying to do great work. They don't have enough support in the leadership bodies at the state and business levels and the academic levels where people are saying, let's come together, let's plan together, let's work together, let's transform this thing. That is not happening. And until we get a Catholic bishop that makes that call, do we have a president of the university that makes that call, to the head of the advocate makes that call, to the governor, et cetera, to all these parties come together and say, let's plan together, let's work together, let's be one people. We're going to continue to have a lot of people who pay a dear price in their health, through the stress that they have for trying to make change or be victims of the way the predominant situation is today.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Mashir Robinson, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much, Jim. God bless you and all of your listeners.
God bless you, and let's talk again very soon.
Sure enough. Bye.
Bye. Now, as Dr. Martin Luther King waved goodbye to the crowd in 1963, on 28 August, he handed a guy named George Raveling the original typewritten I Have a Dream speech. George Raveling later became a famous basketball coach. In fact, he was a head coach of Washington State when I was a freshman at LSU and Washington State played at the Assembly Center. Raveling, now retired, was on the podium with Dr. King at the precise moment that Martin Luther King left, and George Raveling has the original copy of the I Have a Dream speech to this day. Unfortunately, Lisette Oropesa was unable to be with us today. Hopefully we will make contact with Lisette before she appears here on September 8th in our community. But we thank Mashiach Robinson for spending the hour with us, and we thank you for listening as always. Until tomorrow, when we'll have General Honore back for an encore appearance, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.